So to start, I want to welcome all the brethren we have online with us so far, and to introduce Brother Tom, there's really no introduction necessary. About a year and a half ago, as we learned last week from Brother Brett, Brother Dan Larson introduced to the camp committee the subject of Daniel. And so I think this is one of the reasons Brother Tom has also chosen the same subject for today, because Brother Tom and Sister Cheryl were able to go to camp all week. So without further ado, I will introduce Brother Tom and his subject, our Daniel connection.
Brother Paul is right. We were at camp this year, and the theme was Daniel. And I found it to be such a rich theme that we can go over it and over it many times and still be richly blessed by it. There were some wonderful lessons in the book of Daniel. There's great faith of Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And I'll tell you, though, for the first time for me, I felt an almost emotional connection to Daniel when I saw the passion with which he spoke. I hadn't felt that before. In all the times we've studied Daniel, I always looked at it as an important book to analyze, to get the answers right from Daniel. When we looked at Daniel, and I didn't know this either, but there he himself actually had four prophetic visions. The one before were Nebuchadnezzar's, but he only had four. The first was Daniel 7 concerning the four beasts which come out of the sea, and they dominate the earth. The second was the ram and the goat of chapter 8, where the goat was more powerful and overcame the ram. That chapter includes the important prophecy of the 2300 days. The third prophecy given to Daniel was the 70 weeks prophecy, which helped explain when the 2300 days prophecy should begin counting. And also, of course, indicates the date of the first advent. Very important principles that it establishes for our prophetic studies. And, of course, the fourth prophecy covers from chapters 10 through 12. It's the most detailed prophecy describing specific events of the gospel age down to the time of Napoleon and the time of the end. It had to specify when the time of the end would begin, and I think that's why it's so detailed. And there, of course, in chapter 12, Michael stands up for Daniel's people. When we looked at these four briefly, I thought that Daniel's response to chapter 7, the beasts, was very interesting. It says he was most intrigued by the fourth beast, the terrible beast that had 10 horns and that would devour the earth. And I think that one of the reasons he focused on that particular one was not only because of its terrible ferocity and what it would do to his people, but because after its judgment, world dominion would be turned over to the saints. That was a turning point that he understood. This is what it says there. But the judgment shall be set, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Here is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts much troubled me, and my countenance was changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart. So obviously Daniel was very troubled by what he saw here. It says he kept the matter in his heart. In fact, earlier in verse 15, it says that his spirit was grieved. When we look at this particular chapter, we often compare it with Nebuchadnezzar's vision in chapter 2. But there's a difference in the way Daniel responds between these two visions. After explaining the meaning of the dream to Nebuchadnezzar, nowhere does it say that Daniel was troubled by that dream. And I think from a human perspective, from Nebuchadnezzar's perspective, those world empires would be glorious. They would be made of gold, silver, brass, and iron. But when Daniel is given a vision of the same empires, they are depicted as beasts, the last one being dreadful and terrible and exceeding strong. And so the reality of what those kingdoms really would be like was given to a man of faith. But to a man in the flesh, Nebuchadnezzar, they were depicted only the way a human would see them. Now, the reality of that vision is what troubled Daniel. Then in chapter 8, Daniel has a second prophetic vision. The vision looks forward to the Medo-Persian Empire. This is Daniel 8, verses 3 through 7. He says, I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beasts might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. And as I was considering, behold, an he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler against him, and smote the ram, and brake his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground, and stamped upon him. And there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hands. That's an amazing vision for a man to have. But it's really a fairly easy one to explain. And the reason is because the angel explains it to him, at least part of it. He says, the ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. And the rough goat is the king of Grecia. And the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. When Gabriel said that horn between the eyes of the goat was the first king of Greece, the word for first means first in place, time, or rank. So if the goat in ancient Greece is ancient Greece, the king of highest rank, the one who was most renowned in Greek history, conquering portions of the known world, including Medo-Persia, was of course Alexander the Great. The vision says that the goat touched not the ground. That depicts the speed and power with which Alexander conquered the world. This is what Wikipedia says to describe him. He spent most of his ruling years on an unprecedented military campaign through Asia and Northeast Africa. And he created one of the largest empires of the ancient world by the age of 30, stretching from Greece to northwestern India. He was undefeated in battle and is widely considered one of history's most successful military commanders. And of course, history tells us that he did conquer the Persian Empire. It took him only 3 years to conquer what had previously been a world power. The vision continues. It says, therefore, the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones towards the four winds of heaven. Well, history tells us that Alexander died when he was only 32 years old, at the height of his power, when he was strong. There's widespread debate on how such a young, strong man could die so suddenly. Some accounts say he died in a drunken stupor. Others say that he was poisoned. Others say that he had malaria or typhoid fever. So how he died is unknown. But what's important is that he died at the height of his power, as this prophecy says. Then in verse 22, Gabriel says, now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in or not with his power. In other words, after Alexander's death, his kingdom would be divided into four parts, but none of those four would compare to the power that Alexander the Great had in his reign. Now we remember that this vision occurred almost 300 years before Alexander became king of Greece at the age of 20. So his lifespan was only 12 years as a military general, 12 or 13. And so this and other prophecies, brethren, is one of the reasons that we accept the scriptures as divinely inspired, because only God could provide a prophecy so accurate some 300 years before it occurred. Now, history confirms the details here. When four generals of Alexander fought for each other and eventually divided his kingdom amongst themselves. Here's a map showing where Alexander's kingdom started. There on the left in purple at the top is Macedonia. That's where he started, and that was the limit of his father's reign. And then the green shows the broad extent to which it eventually reached. And here are the names of the four generals who, after Alexander's death, fought for control and finally decided to divide the kingdom up between them. You have Cassander, Lysimachus, Ptolemy, and Seleucus. Now, the reason I arranged them that way on the slide is because that's generally the area that they controlled. Here's another map showing how Alexander's kingdom was divided. In the green on the upper left is Macedonia, taken by Cassander. In orange is Western Asia Minor and Thrace, controlled by Lysimachus. In blue there is Ptolemy's Egypt. And, of course, the largest segment in yellow was Mesopotamia and Central Asia, held by Seleucus. And then Gabriel continued his prophecy. He says, "And out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great towards the south and towards the east and towards the pleasant land. And it waxed great even unto the host of heaven. And it cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And an host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression. And it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint saith unto that certain saint which spake, How long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice, and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said unto me, Unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed." Well, when the angel was describing the Medo-Persian ram, I thought this was an interesting way he described their level of power. He said that the Medo-Persian ram would be great. When he described the Grecian goat, he said it would be very great. But now he says that the little horn would be exceeding great. There is a progression of strength in these descriptions. The little horn would become the greatest power the earth had ever seen. The Roman Empire culturally grew out of the Macedonian Empire, the Greek Empire. The influence of Greeks was all through Rome. This prophecy said that the next empire after Greece would expand east and south and to the glorious land. Now, if you look at this map of the Roman Empire at its zenith, you will see it expanded every direction. But the prophecy is very specific because it was saying that the Roman Empire would take over the Grecian Empire, which was east and south of Rome. And, of course, the glorious land is a reference to the land of Israel. Rome, like Greece, controlled Israel. And, of course, that was a key in Daniel's mind. But in this expansion, there is one more expansion that Rome would make. The little horn was to expand upward to the host of heaven. Gabriel said he exalted himself to the prince of the host, taking away the daily sacrifice and casting down the sanctuary of God. Well, now there's a shift in history. No longer is it just military expansion. Now we see the little horn expanding to heaven, actually fighting against the God of heaven. The host and the stars that were cast down represent the saints down through the age who were hated and persecuted, in some cases almost to extinction. And of course, history confirms this prophecy. It overflows with atrocities committed by the papal system. You read about the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre when thousands of Huguenots were slaughtered in Paris just because they weren't Catholic. Or we read of the Albigensian Crusades initiated by Pope Innocent III, which was a 20-year war to eliminate these brethren from France. Papacy put the Pope in the place of Christ, and through the Mass took away the value of the continual sacrifice of Christ. And I'll tell you, one of the sad statements of this prophecy is that he cast truth to the ground. That is the key when we start talking about the cleansing of the sanctuary, that the cleansing will be the lifting up of that which was trampled down. And so the scriptures were replaced by church tradition, and decisions made by church councils. The Bible became irrelevant, in fact, hidden and chained away so people couldn't read it. And even today, to most Catholics, the Bible doesn't mean all that much. And when Daniel heard the explanation of the angel Gabriel, he was devastated. In verse 27, it says, "I, Daniel, fainted and was sick certain days. Afterward, I rose up and did the king's business, and I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it." So you think, well, if he didn't understand it, why was he so troubled by it? He had heard one of the angels ask the other angel, "How long will it be until the sanctuary is cleansed?" And of course, the answer was 2,300 days. But little of this really made sense to Daniel himself. 2,300 days is about 6.5 years. He knew the vision had begun with the Medo-Persian Empire being conquered by Greece, and he knew that Greece was going to be conquered by some greater power, and I'm sure he understood that none of that was going to happen in 6.5 years. And then in addition, in verse 26, Gabriel had said to him, "Shut thou up the vision, for it shall be for many days." And so, although Daniel must have understood the first part of the vision about Medo-Persia and Greece, he was deeply troubled by the evil that was still to come and by the length of time it appeared that it would take before this evil influence could be defeated. And I thought that was very much like his reaction in chapter 7 when he saw that terrible beast and he was so distressed by it. Remember that Daniel's chief concern was for the welfare of Israel and the desire to have the temple in Israel in Jerusalem restored. But this vision, and the one in chapter 7, was much larger and would affect the whole world. So I think that Daniel knew Gabriel was giving him far more than he was asking. But again, for him, the focus was on the immediate problem, and that was Israel's captivity. And then when we move into chapter 9, we see that Daniel took to the books. He studied the prophecies in Jeremiah. And he saw there that the desolation of Israel would not be permanent. So in the first 19 verses of chapter 9, he pleads with God to restore Israel, Jerusalem, and the temple. This is what he says in verses 17 and 18. He says, "Now therefore, O our God, hearken unto the prayer of thy servant and to his supplications, and cause thy face to shine upon thy sanctuary that is desolate for the Lord's sake. O my God, incline thine ear and hear. Open thine eyes and behold our desolations and the city which is called by thy name. For we do not present our supplications before thee for our righteousness, but for thy great mercy's sake." Now, Gabriel had just given the prophecy of cleansing of the sanctuary, so it was natural and appropriate for Daniel to ask that Jerusalem's sanctuary be cleansed. And so the rest of chapter 9 is Gabriel's message to Daniel to comfort him and to give him some insight as to what this was all about. It says, "While I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel and presenting my supplication before Jehovah my God for the holy mountain of my God, yea, while I was speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning in chapter 8, being caused to fly swiftly, touched me about the time of the evening oblation. And he instructed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I am now come forth to give thee wisdom and understanding. At the beginning of thy supplications, the commandment went forth. And I am come to tell thee, for thou art greatly beloved. Therefore, consider the matter and understand the vision." Well, he says, this was Gabriel who appeared to me earlier in the vision. Well, that had to be chapter 8. And so that's the vision that he's referring back to, the vision of the 2,300 days of cleansing the sanctuary. So what Gabriel is about to say to Daniel relates to the prophecy of the 2,300 days. And because of that, Brother Russell and others have concluded that the 70 weeks prophecy marks the beginning of the 2,300 days. And what makes the 70 weeks prophecy so helpful to us is that we can now see a historical fulfillment of that prophecy. And because that prophecy was fulfilled in such perfect details, it tells us that we can be confident in the fulfillment of the 2300 days prophecy. Now, Daniel may not have understood the year for a day principle, but the 70 weeks prophecy proves to us that that day for a year is a valid approach when we deal with time prophecy. But Daniel must have realized here again that this prophecy was going to extend far beyond his own lifetime. This is what Gabriel says next. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city to finish the transgression and to make an end of sins and to make reconciliation for iniquity and to bring in everlasting righteousness and to seal up the vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The streets shall be built again and the wall even in troublous times. When he says that 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and the holy city, again, Daniel wanted the literal temple cleansed and Jerusalem restored. But there was a larger cleansing and restoration that Gabriel was revealing to Daniel. The temple would be restored. That's shown in that first division of the 70 weeks, that first part where it says 7 weeks are determined. 7 weeks is 49 years. The restoration of Israel and Jerusalem and the temple was restored within that first period of the prophecy. But in reality, that was a minor point. The more important cleansing was going to require the death of Jesus. The first word mentioned, the first work mentioned in this prophecy is to finish the transgression. A better translation for the word transgression is the word rebellion, to finish the rebellion. Israel was not the only group of people that rebelled against God. That's why the prophecy is pointing to a future work, a work that would finish the rebellion, not only of Israel, but of the world of mankind. When Adam disobeyed, he began mankind's rebellion. Really, the second rebellion in history, the first rebellion being Lucifer, but even his rebellion would be dealt with in the providing of the ransom. And so once the ransom was provided, the spiritual temple, which Gabriel had prophesied would itself become corrupted, could be cleansed after 2,300 years. And then when Gabriel said that 70 weeks are determined upon thy people, the word determined means to cut off or mark off. Gabriel is saying that the 70 weeks prophecy is marked off as the beginning of the 2,300 days prophecy when the sanctuary of chapter 8 would be cleansed. He then gives Daniel the starting point of both prophecies. He says, when the command is given to restore and build Jerusalem. Brother Russell uses the decree given by Artaxerxes to Nehemiah in 454 BC. 70 weeks is 490 days, as you know, or 490 prophetic years, and that takes us to AD 36, being the end of the 70 weeks prophecy. But Gabriel said the sacrifice and oblation would cease in the midst of the 70th week. So if you go back from the 70th week to the midst of the week, that takes you to 33 AD, the year that Jesus was crucified. And then, of course, if you go to the beginning of the 70th week, it takes us to AD 29, the date of Jesus' baptism. I will say, however, that Brother David Rice has a minor adjustment to these dates. And so if you are interested, I would encourage you to look into it. He begins counting in 458 and ends the 70 weeks at AD 33. And I'm sure that minor change raises some questions in your mind. And I would urge you not to dismiss it too quickly. But that's not my point of focus today or what I'm leading to. So I'm going to leave that investigation up to you. What I want to see here is that the answer to Daniel was much larger than his original question. His mind was on the restoration of Israel, but Gabriel answers by pointing to the world Savior. And so before any meaningful cleansing or restoration work could happen, the ransom had to be provided. That's why these two prophecies are so connected, because the ransom would allow the fulfillment of this prophecy. So where does the 2,300 days take us to? Well, 2,300 years from 454 takes us to 1855. In the third volume, Brother Russell uses 1856, but that does not account for there being no zero year between B.C. and A.D., so you really have to subtract one. When you subtract 454 B.C. from 2,300 years, you also have to subtract one because of that being no zero year. I'll just give you one more comment. Brother David begins the counting of his prophecy from the decree given in Ezra chapter 7 in 458, and he does account for there being no zero year. And that takes us to 1843, the year that William Miller predicted would be the return of Christ. And so the question is, why is this significant? Here's a quote from an issue of the Herald magazine titled Bible Student History. It says, "He," that is Miller, "utilized Daniel and Revelation as keys to the Bible's prophetic outline. His arguments for Christ's return focus largely on the time of his return. The manner and object were to be visible and awesome. Time elements that Miller considered biblical encompassed the days of Daniel, 1260, 1290, 1335, and 2300, the times of the Gentiles, the Jubilee cycles, and the 6,000 years of human history. He reckoned them all as ending in 1843, except the 1260, which he said ended in 1793 to 98. So the great focus of Miller's work was the second presence of the Lord. And between 1840 and 1844, interest in Second Advent studies grew tremendously, particularly in the U.S. and particularly on the East Coast and the Midwest. Here's a more quote from that Herald issue. It says, "Wide-ranging discussions about prophecy in general and the Second Coming in particular took place within the growing Millerite camps and among Christian contemporaries. It encompassed journals, conferences, camp meetings, books, pamphlets, speaking tours, and debates. Miller himself devoted years to public speaking on the Advent to whomever would listen. Many others joined in. Of note was Joshua V. Himes, Charles Fitch, Josiah Litch, Joseph J. Bates, and George Storrs. Advent journals, including the Signs of the Times, the Bible Examiner, and the Midnight Cry, among many others. Use of charts to illustrate God's prophetic plan was common, based on the words of Habakkuk 2:2. They endeavored to make the vision plain. Tabernacle and temple symbolism was prominent, especially in connection with the vision of the 2,300 days in Daniel 8. Christ, as antitypical high priest, would return soon to cleanse and restore his spiritual temple." And when you look at some of the history and hear their recounting of it, there was a great anticipation and joy in the Adventists at the time. Just think of it, brethren, if you believed that the Lord was going to return visibly in 1843. Imagine standing in the field waiting for the Lord to appear and take you to heaven. For so many, it was a powerful moment, a powerful day. So for those who put their faith in the prophecy of the 2,300 days, they felt tremendous joy and anticipation of what was to come. But as we know, 1843 came and went. And understandably, there was great disappointment. Others in the movement, they went back to the prophecies, they reexamined them, and they readjusted their expectation to the seventh month of the following year. And they even had a specific date, you see it there on the sign, October 22nd, 1844. And they came up with that because they said that was the Day of Atonement in Israel. That was the day, they said, the high priest came out and blessed the people. And so Jesus, as the high priest, would come out and bless the people after the end of the spiritual Day of Atonement. Unfortunately, if you look at Leviticus 16, the high priest doesn't do that on the Day of Atonement. He does that on the day of the consecration of the priesthood in chapter 9. So they kind of misinterpreted that a little bit too. But then on October 22nd, 1844, when midnight struck and they realized that they had been wrong, what disappointment again. And many left the movement feeling that they had been deceived. And when I was thinking about this whole prophecy, I wondered, why would God give a prophecy, a time prophecy, that led to the wrong date? And I came to the conclusion that it wasn't the wrong date. It was simply the wrong expectation. 1843 was not intended to mark the Lord's return, as the Millerites believed. But it did point to the refining of the church's understanding of vital doctrines in preparation for the coming harvest. And here's an important point we learn when we study time prophecy. Time prophecy takes us to the beginning of a process. The 2300 years prophecy took us to the beginning of the prophecy of refining truth doctrines that were going to be essential at the end of the age. And in fact, you see that same principle carried over also in 1874, the actual return of the Lord. The Lord didn't return and then instantly set up his kingdom. He returned secretly to begin that long process of taking mankind to their extremity so that they would be prepared for the kingdom. 1914 was not the end of the world order as we know it, but it began the process of tearing down the systems of this world, a process that would be long and difficult for this world to endure. And you know, brethren, it's understandable that we would make that mistake. Not necessarily in the time feature of prophecy, but in the expectations of what would happen on those dates. Here's another quote from the Herald regarding what happened after the disappointment. Following the 1843-1844 disappointments, stores continued to preach the advent without dates. In later autobiographical sketches, he recounts his encounter with books of the English writer Henry Dunn about the ransom doctrine and the restitution of all things. One book was titled The Destiny of the Human Race. He then reactivated the Bible Examiner in 1871 after a lapse of about 8 years and reworked it to incorporate the thoughts of the ransom for all and restitution of all things. The masthead scripture was 1 Timothy 2:5 and 6. His conclusion, the plan of God extended beyond the few faithful to the entire human race. The Abrahamic promise applied to all men during a soon-to-come earthly kingdom. The general concept of God having a plan was popular among contemporary Advent Christian writers. Miller had a lot of those things wrong, but you can see the refining process. In fact, Brother Russell mentions George Storrs on reprint 71 in glowing terms, and he even asked George Storrs if he would write articles for the Watchtower, which he was unable to do because of ill health. But on reprint 623, Brother Russell reprints an old article written by Storrs against the Calvinist doctrine of predestination with generally the correct understanding of election. In fact, Brother Russell even contributed some articles to Storrs' publication, The Bible Examiner. So if you get a chance to read it, there's a nice biographical sketch of George Storrs in that Herald issue I mentioned. But of course, there were others who helped clarify the truth. For example, Henry Grew published pamphlets against the doctrine of the immortal soul, against the Trinity and hellfire. He taught the resurrection of mankind to a millennial judgment period. And I thought it was so providential when I read that George Storrs just happened to pick up one of Grew's pamphlets on the floor of a train that he was riding. And he read it, and he was so touched by that truth that it helped him to influence Brother Russell to see these precious truths. These are precious truths. We're talking about fundamental concepts of God's plan, about the ransom, the salvation, the earthly kingdom. These are truths that were just coming together. And so we see in the whole process that truth doctrines were coming together piece by piece in a gradual unfolding. The sanctuary of truth was being cleansed. Here's another quote from that Herald. As we look at the Miller movement after 1844, we find that three main branches developed having the spirit of that movement. These are the Seventh-day Adventists, the Advent Christian Church, or Second Adventists, and the Bible students founded by Charles Taze Russell and his associates. The Bible students were the only branch to retain and build on the mature Advent faith of George Storrs. He anticipated or founded central points of later Bible student thinking. A second Adventist preacher named Jonas Wendell was preaching the imminent coming of the Lord in a book titled Present Truth in 1870. In this book, he projected the date of 1873 as the second coming of the Lord. It was through his preaching that he rekindled the faith of a man almost by accident. This man stumbled into a dirty, dingy hall one day when Jonas Wendell was preaching and was so intrigued by his views that his faith in the Bible was restored. That man was Pastor Charles Taze Russell. Well, Brother Russell's providential stumbling into that dingy hall, brethren, is something that we can all be grateful for. He brought an energy and zeal to the spread of these truths that had been lost in Miller's disappointments. And I thought about that, and I thought, well, maybe that's why the Lord didn't expose Brother Russell to the Miller views too early, so Brother Russell wouldn't have to overcome their disappointments. Now, he had been disillusioned with Christianity in general because of eternal torment, but it happens that the Millerites didn't believe in eternal torment. They believed that at death, it was a state of oblivion. And so I think the timing of exposing Brother Russell to these new views and the return of Christ and all these beautiful doctrines was absolutely the perfect timing in preparation for the harvest. And then, of course, there was Nelson Barber, who was a former Millerite and associate of Jonas Wendell. From Barber, Brother Russell learned about the parallel dispensations. He learned of the Jewish double, the Jubilees, the 1260, 1290, and 1335 days of Daniel. He learned that the Lord invisibly returned in 1874. He learned of the harvest as well as the Gentile times ending in 1914. And so after paying for Barber to come and meet with Brother Russell personally, he was convinced from Scripture that these were important truths. And based on that, Brother Russell began his own ministry, and he started calling Christians to come out of Babylon. It was time to come out, according to Revelation 18. And of course, there's so much more history, and there's so many more brethren who were part of the work. And so, how does all this help us see our Daniel connection? You remember Daniel agonized over the prophecies he was given. He knew they were a long way off and that there was much suffering and corruption that would happen before the time of the end. Brethren, we're there. We're living in the time of the end. The sanctuary class has learned the truth, truth that was trampled down for centuries, but now is finally being lifted up. How he would have rejoiced to see these things fulfilled. We've seen the rebirth of Daniel's people. We know that the Lord has returned as in the process of setting up his kingdom. We know all the things that Daniel longed to know. And so we are connected with him, both spiritually and for me, emotionally. We want the kingdom for very similar reasons that Daniel wanted Israel restored, because it will mean the blessing of others. It will mean the universal worship of God for who he really is. And it will mean the lifting up of truth where it belongs. But now that the ransom has been provided and the church is almost complete, greater things than Daniel had prayed for will soon become a reality. The kingdom is right on the horizon. And so by honoring these truths, we join our hearts with the great prophets who God first honored by speaking through them. By appreciating their lives of faith and doing the best that we can to copy them. We are connected in the most meaningful way possible, and that's through the Word of God. Brethren, may the Lord help us see our spiritual kinship to not just those prophets, but to our brethren at the end of the age who have gone before us and worked so hard to find these truths, to treasure them, and to share them with others. May he help us to that end.